This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
Later on, a band-aid approach to our hemorrhaging healthcare system continues to prevail with U.S. Congressman John Conyers. Plus, if you want to get sick to your stomach, then think about the cost of being sick in America.
Well, now a frightening look at a new Harvard study finds that medical problems contributed to nearly two-thirds of all bankruptcies. Surprisingly, most of those bankrupted by medical problems actually had health insurance.
Covering the uninsured isn't enough, but unfortunately, Washington politicians seem all too ready to cave into insurance firms.
We're joined by Dr. David Himmelstein, primary care physician, associate professor of medicine, Harvard Medical School, and co-founder of Physicians for a National Health Program. And it's a pleasure to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Is there any real likelihood, what's the push that's still going on for passage of real health care reform legislation, H.R. 676, a single-payer or Medicare for All bill?
Well, there's a lot of effort and a lot of activity. Single payer is really the only reform approach that has real grassroots support behind it, and that support continues to ramp up. And I mean, we'll see how far we actually get in this round of debate over health reform, but we're seeing tremendous mobilization of people who want real reform.
And for those people who want real reform but buy into the fact that other systems which call themselves universal reform can do the trick, why don't you just tell us a bit about the virtues of 676 Medicare for All?
Well, 676 is really what we used to call in the old days just plain old national health insurance. Government collects the money as taxes and pays the bills. Doctors and hospitals would still remain private mostly, so doctors would mainly remain in private practice, and most hospitals would still be private hospitals, but they'd be paid by the government insurance program, and virtually all private insurance would be eliminated. Basically, something like Medicare, but upgraded and improved from Medicare and covering all Americans for all necessary medical care without copayments, without deductibles, and without limits.
Now, I do want to get into the issue of the Harvard study. It's really quite staggering, and I want you to lay out the implications for us and the extent of two-thirds of all bankruptcies are really stimulated by medical problems, and most of those people actually are the insured. What's going on?
I mean, I think the first thing that's important to know is bankruptcy is common. A lot of people don't like to talk about it because it's considered shameful in our culture, I guess. But about as many American women file for bankruptcy each year as graduate from college. So this is something that affects a lot of people. And as you say, we found, really to our surprise, that the share of bankruptcies that have a major medical problem as a part of the cause, or sometimes all of the cause, is now about two-thirds, and that's up from only about 45%. I say only about 45%. That's still a high figure, but it was 45% back in 2001. 2007, when we collected this data, it was the comparable figure was 68% if you measured it in exactly the same way. We think 62% is a conservative figure if you demand even more evidence that something was medical.
And what's the stimulant? What exactly is the problem, particularly for people who are insured?
You know, it's a variety of things, and there are a couple of common themes. One is copayments and deductibles. So it's very common for people to have $5,000, $10,000, $15,000 in uncovered bills when they're sick because they've got a policy that pays 80% of the cost, or that has a $500 deductible before it pays anything, or doesn't cover more than a month of physical therapy, or when actually you might need 4 months of physical therapy to recover. I mean, for instance, just from a standard kind of run-of-the-mill soccer injury for your kid, they might need 4 months of physical therapy after their knee surgery. So that's one thing, is a lot of medical care that you're left paying for despite having coverage. A second thing is a lot of people, when they get sick, they end up losing their job because of it. And once they lose their job, they lose their insurance. So they start out being insured, and because they're sick, they lose their insurance. And I guess the third thing is that even if you've got good health insurance, most of us don't have anything approaching good disability insurance. So part of the problem that we saw is people who got sick, and even if their medical bills were covered, they were losing income because they weren't able to work, and therefore the illness drove them to bankruptcy.
Now, in the coming debate over health care, which really has started but really is going to start getting hot, the majority of the Democrats are saying, well, there is a public sector option, there's a Medicare-like option in Obama's health care bill to have competition between the private and public sector. Would that work?
Well, I think it's a pretty pale imitation of single-payer that doesn't do very much. You know, part of what a single-payer plan does is it gets you tremendous administrative and bureaucratic savings, not just by saying we're going to lower insurance overhead, but also by eliminating a lot of the insurance paperwork that hospitals and doctors and nursing homes need to do. So the average American hospital is spending about a quarter of its budget on its administrative apparatus. And if you don't have multiple payers for care, you can simplify that. You can pay a hospital like a fire department is paid. It gets a budget to cover its entire operation for the year and maybe gets one check a month for all of its operations. If you've still got a government insurance plan alongside multiple private insurance plan, you can't do that kind of administrative simplification. And our calculation is that you save only about 7 or 8% as much with the public option plan as you could potentially with a single payer. And because of that, you end up spending about $150 billion more each year to get universal coverage under a public option kind of program than under single payer. And that makes it not economically viable. I mean, what it's saying is we're going to spend the $2 trillion each year we're already spending, and on top of that, we're going to add $150 billion more. And already our economy and our population is struggling under those costs, and to add to it additional costs and no real cost containment just doesn't work. So what we're concerned with is, yeah, maybe politically you can get that passed, but economically and medically, it's not viable. And the plans being talked about don't actually upgrade coverage. So single payer, because you save so much on bureaucracy, you can give people first dollar coverage. You can eliminate the copayments, eliminate the deductibles. But under the plans being floated in Washington, people who have private coverage would basically see no improvement in what they have today. So the medical bankruptcy issue really isn't addressed at all under that kind of plan.
One of the things that was so remarkable about the study is there is this estimate that 49.6% between 2001 and 2007 of the bankruptcies were attributable to medical problems. I mean, that's really a staggering increase. And what provoked, or what's the catalyst for that great, great increase?
Well, I think the catalyst is rising medical care costs and declining insurance coverage. Employers are cutting back their coverage or raising copayments, raising deductibles, and are shedding workers ever faster once they're sick. So all of those things are getting worse, and they're getting worse fast.
And who are the people now that are declaring bankruptcy?
Well, bankruptcy is a middle-class phenomena. Basically, in order to run up the debts to go bankrupt, you pretty much have to have credit. And poor people can't get credit, and they can't afford the bankruptcy lawyers and filings that it takes to file for formal bankruptcy. So people who file for bankruptcy are almost all middle-class or upper-class people. Most of them are homeowners, or at least they owned a home until their bankruptcy filing. The vast majority went to college and had what are generally considered pretty reasonably good jobs. So, I mean, that's what, in a way, is very most striking to us, is this is an indicator that unless you're extraordinarily wealthy in our society, you're really at risk. you know, you're one illness away from financial disaster if you're sick.
Really is amazing how much the single-payer proponents are being shut out of the debate, especially given the fact of the popularity of the plan. Do you have any indication at all that this may change?
Well, we actually got invited to meet with Max Baucus last week. A couple of us did. And he was kind of apologetic. He's the chair of the Senate Finance Committee, who's been sort of running health policy, health reform debate in the Senate. And he said he's been up to Canada and he saw that their healthcare system is terrific and it really works well and didn't hear any complaints about it. And then the next breath he said, but we're not going to do that. And then he said, I think I made a mistake by ruling a single payer off the table and not allowing it to be part of the hearings, but it's too late to go back on that. We're too far down the road now and we can't go back. So I think we've begun to get to the powers that be and make them a little bit nervous. We hear that Max Baucus, wherever he goes in Montana, whenever he meets with a crowd, is kind of getting harangued about refusing to allow a single payer into the debate. But we haven't applied nearly enough pressure at this point to actually get them to behave, and that's the challenge we face, is we're going to have to be very, very vigorous in protest and make the politicians listen.
Dr. Himmelstein, the New York Times certainly trumpeted a draft proposal that was circulated on Friday by Senator Edward Kennedy and preferenced it by his own health problems and his own dedication throughout his career around health care. What can you tell us about, what do you think about any of the details such as they were that were within the Edward Kennedy health care proposal?
Well, what he's laid out is almost exactly what we have here in Massachusetts, which is already falling apart. I mean, what he's saying is they're going to expand Medicaid or a Medicaid-like program for poor people and the near poor, and then some partial subsidies a little above that. And above for middle-income people, they're basically going to pass a law that says you have to buy insurance. You know, it's a little bit like saying we're going to order that people have to bake delicious chocolate chip cookies with no calories in them. The problem with ordering you to buy insurance is they can't order that it actually be affordable. So, yeah, Americans want insurance, but basically what this is saying is we're going to make you buy a defective product. And we know in Massachusetts what that means. 500 doctors signed a letter recently to Senator Kennedy asking him, saying him, the health reform isn't working here in Massachusetts. And please do single payer instead, 500 of our colleagues from this state. And why is that? It's because 15% of the people in Massachusetts still say they can't afford care. They've made it a crime to not have health insurance with a fine of $1,000 if you don't have health insurance, which is as big a fine as for making a terrorist threat or spousal abuse. So it's a serious crime. But the policies they've actually been able to get for people, you know, for someone my age, you pay almost $5,000 for a policy for one person that has a $2,000 deductible before it pays for any health care at all, and then 20% of the costs above that are co-payments. So you're basically paying almost $7,000 before you have any coverage at all under this Massachusetts plan, and that's pretty much what Kennedy is prescribing for the nation. That is not viable coverage for most Americans, and there's no cost containment. The program in Massachusetts has increased costs by what would, if you project it nationwide, about $150 billion each year and growing, and that's the reason why in our state right now the legislature is debating throwing 28,000 people off the subsidized coverage because the costs are unbearable, and why we're shutting down public hospitals and clinics because the state is draining money out of one piece of poor people's health care in order to try and keep their health program afloat, sort of on the other hand. That just doesn't work as long-term health reform, and that's almost identical to what Kennedy is actually proposing now.
And I'm just curious, why, of all people, couldn't Kennedy be brought on board with the Conyers bill? Why does he not support H.R. 676?
I think Ted Kennedy is a desperate man at this point who's desperate to see something, almost anything, passed in his lifetime in health reform. And that has led him to make some unfortunate decisions.
And where are you off to now? I gather Washington?
I was going to go to Washington to testify, but other colleagues from Physicians for National Health Program are testifying instead. And we have lots of good spokespeople and happy to say that they didn't need me, or I guess Wednesday in D.C.
I think they always need you. And in the final seconds, what is it that we really need to do to get real universal health care?
Well, we need to push our members of Congress and the president to actually do what needs to be done. So in New York, you know, Charlie Rangel is the chairman of one of the key committees in Congress. He needs to hold hearings on single payer, not just the kind of pro-insurance company reforms that are being debated. And he needs to ask the Congressional Budget Office and the General Accountability Office to actually look at what would single-payer cost as compared to the things they're talking about and how good would the coverage be. And other members of Congress and senators from New York, Mr. Schumer is on the Senate Finance Committee. That's the key committee in the Senate. He ought to be pushed on single-payer, and other members of the congressional delegation as well. And eventually, I hope doesn't come to this, but we may need to ask people to join us in civil disobedience in Washington and actually calling attention to the fact that politicians are being bought and sold at this point.
And we just happen to have the number for Charlie Rangel.
Just happen to have it.
212-663-3900. That is 212-663-3900. Tell him to get on board H.R. 676. There really have to be the kind of hearings that bring us to the point of a real single-payer or Medicare for all, real universal health care. And thank you, as always, for your extremely insightful comments. And we have been speaking with Dr. David Himmelstein.
Thanks for having me.
The voices for comprehensive, meaningful health care reform, like Representative John Conyers, whose legislation H.R. 676, a single-payer or a Medicare for All bill, continued to be raised. Representative Conyers makes the case for health care for all at an event honoring one of the most vocal proponents of single-payer, Marilyn Clement, National Coordinator of Health Care Now.
This is a historic moment in the history of healthcare in this country. And for Marilyn Clement, for her to keep the energy going till we get universal single-payer healthcare. We want her there when we go over the finish line. Millions, not thousands. Millions of people are with us in spirit as we gather here in Manhattan just to come together at this very crucial moment. I know the score. I know that King was told he couldn't do it. I know that Mandela was told that he couldn't do it. I know that Rosa Parks was told she couldn't do it. I know that Barack Obama was told he couldn't do it, and yet we now are faced with the same thoughtful, mostly sincere, mostly people who are telling us that we can't do it. Let me tell you something. If we don't get this now, would somebody please tell me when they think we're going to get it? We want it now. Right now. Get that? I'm tired of hearing people tell me, it's not for me, it's for my kids. I don't want it. If you don't have it, you haven't got anything to leave to your kids, you jerk. There's nothing left. You can't leave them something you don't have. You want it for them. I want it for me. I want it for Clement. I want it for you, because we're going to need it before our kids. And also, they told Ella Baker that she couldn't do it. Now, this is like D-Day in World War II. This is it. It is my intention that all 78 of us in the Congress that support this direction make it perfectly clear to my beloved Nancy Pelosi and the majority leader, Steny Hoyer, and everybody else that thinks they're a leader in the Congress. We're all smart. Yeah, right. But some of us are timid. Some of us, you know how many times people come to me, John, I'm for your bill. It's the best thing in the world, but we'll never get it. Do you know how that makes me feel about a person? They don't even understand their history. That's how this country was formed, because a third of the people were for breaking with England, a third of them were against breaking with England, and a third were so timid they couldn't take a position one way or the other. This is the way we make progress. Roosevelt told A. Philip Randolph when he was getting ready to do the march, he said, make me do it. And A. Philip Randolph, boy, they gathered people for that march, and he got the call. He said, okay, come to the White House. You won, you made him do it. So Barack Obama, you know how much I love you, but I'm gonna make you do it. Not me personally. It'll be because millions of people, most people in this country, want our plan, and we're not going to be sidetracked by anybody in Washington, D.C. Nobody. So, class, here is your assignment. My buddy, Charlie Rangel, who was on this bill from the first day 9 years ago when I introduced it, but isn't on it right now. John, he says, you know I'm with you, don't you? Yes, Charlie. You see, but as being the chairman of one of the three committees, Ron, I don't want to be seen as partial. I want to be impartial so I can do the most to help you. So that's why I didn't go on the bill. Yeah, right. Okay. I said, Charlie, there's only one thing I ask of you, is that we are not going to be politely put in the closet in June of 2009 after all the people who wanted this bill have their hopes and prayers tied to it. I want a hearing in your committee, Ways and Means. Here's your assignment. I want you to talk to Charlie, visit Charlie. Look, all of you know Charlie Rangel here. You gotta go to him and say your buddy John Conyers, who's respected you from the first day you walked into the House of Representatives, is begging you to hold a hearing. George Miller agreed. It's funny thing, the three committee chairmen, they were all 676. Miller is on 676 and still on it, and said, I agree to have a hearing. Henry Waxman was on it. Well, you don't have to go far to figure out why if you see the list of members in California that are on this bill, including the new Secretary of Labor, Hilda Solis, and a whole slew of California members. But Henry Waxman is not on it either. But he agreed Friday that he'll work on it. Well, we'll work on you while you work on it. because, you know, it's one thing to lose in the house, but it's another thing to be put in the closet. No hearing, no discussion. This is the bill that's got more supporters than any other health care bill in the Congress. And they're talking about, we don't have time, it's too late. No, look, my friends, we're gonna have hearings if we have to hold them ourselves. And by the way, and I am, you know, I'm a nice guy, polite, I run a very democratic ship, but if you don't want any health bill at all, just mess with me, okay? Well, I've overstayed my time. I was thinking Donna was gonna get the hook. But you know what you gotta do? And they'll be saying, uh-oh, the universal healthcare people are at it again, and they mean business.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our new website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.